I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. One of the big tests for tomorrow's primary is how Pennsylvania's new voter ID law is going to work. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Voters will have to show an ID at the polls, but if it doesn't meet the state requirements, they can still cast their ballot. That won't be true in the fall when the mandate goes into full effect. No proper photo ID, no vote. Tuesday's primary has not generated the excitement it did a few weeks ago when eyes were on Rick Santorum. Could he beat Mitt Romney in his home state where he was shellacked back in 2006? The polls were turning against Santorum, and a few weeks ago he suspended his campaign. But that doesn't mean that there aren't races and issues of importance. So here to talk Pennsylvania politics and presidential politics are Tom Farrick and Michael Young. Tom is senior editor of Metropolis, that's a Philadelphia news and commentary website. He's covered government and politics in Pennsylvania since 1974, many of those years at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he worked as a reporter, a columnist, and an editor. And Tom, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Michael Young, and Mike is a managing partner of Michael Young Strategic Research. He's also co-author with Terry McDonough of Politically Uncorrected, and that's a twice monthly column published by Franklin and Marshall College. And Mike Young, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
And nice to be back. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. Tom, let me begin with you, and I don't want to prejudge tomorrow's primary, but who or what benefits if there is low voter turnout?
Well, incumbents benefit because, the core comes out, not the additional people. And I think it'll make a difference, for instance, in the Republican primary race for the U.S. Senate.
Right.
You have some candidates. You have five candidates running for the right, the dubious right, of opposing Bob Casey in the fall. And my theory is that the core of the Republican voters, i.e. the most conservative voters who are the most motivated, will show up. And I think that benefits a couple of the more conservative candidates in that race. That's just an example.
Mike, same question to you. What do you think, or who do you think benefits from a low voter turnout?
Well, I agree with Tom. Incumbents are the big winners in a low voter turnout. It's sometimes referred to as a party primary, and the opportunities for the party to galvanize the base are much greater when fewer and fewer voters turn out. In addition to the races that he mentioned, it's possible that the Democratic race for Attorney General might be affected by low turnout, too, with perhaps Patrick Murphy getting a bit of an edge from a lower turnout than above average turnout.
And he's up against Kathleen Kane.
Kathleen Kane.
And in what seems like, at least, and I'll throw this back to you, Mike, a kind of a hard-fought race, at least on the airwaves.
It has been. It's been. It's probably been certainly one of the hottest races of the season, and most paid attention to. She is perceived as perhaps being ahead, or the race is at least very close at this point, primarily because she has been able to spend quite a lot of money in the race, and she was able to take the race to her opponent pretty early with some pretty strong ads, and so she is. It's certainly a tight race at this point, and one that's going to matter a lot statewide, because the Democrats have never won the office of Attorney General since it was instituted under the new Constitution in 1980,
really?
And many believe this could be a year in which the Democrats could make a fight out of that office.
Tom, going back to something you said about the five Republicans running to be the Senate nominee for the U.S. Senate, you called it dubious. Why dubious? And, of course, they're up against
Well, it's a dubious distinction to oppose an incumbent U.S. senator. And I think that a lot of the named Republicans in the state decided not to make this race. Mm-hmm. And I think the perception is that Casey cannot be beat. They believe that there is a tie between his fate and Obama's fate. I tend to say that there probably is a tie if the president lost Pennsylvania by 12 points. But there's been a history of incumbent senators surviving their president going down. The most famous example is U. Scott back in the 60s when Johnson won the state by a million votes, and U. Scott hung on as a Republican senator.
Oh, interesting.
It was the Goldwater wipeout in the 60s. So I think Casey's a formidable candidate, and I think that you have to count him clearly as the favorite.
Well, and he's got that Casey name, which resonates
Casey
in Pennsylvania.
Casey name, incumbency, he'll have plenty of money.
Right.
I think that if you get a Republican candidate like Sam Rohr winning this race on the Republican side, you will have sort of a Tea Party Republican. Mm-hmm. And if you have a Tea Party Republican, that's great for the primary, and that may help him win. Not so good in the fall.
There's another subtext to this race that's interesting as well, and that is that Governor Corbett has spent quite a lot of political capital getting the party endorsement for Steve Welch. And some believe that Welch is in trouble. His main opponent is a guy by the name of Smith from the center-west part of the state who has spent quite a lot of money on ads, raised his ID considerably, and many think it's a two-way race at this point, with perhaps Smith in the ascendancy. If the governor's endorsed candidate does go down, it's going to be a slap in the face at Corbett and certainly some loss of stature for him.
Interesting. Well, speaking of a Pennsylvania senator, we need to talk about Rick Santorum. As we know, earlier this month, Tommy suspended his campaign. I know that that word is used in a very strategic kind of way, mm-hmm. but it looks like he was reading the tea leaves and the tea leaves were telling him he was going to have a big struggle in the Commonwealth.
The math was against him, even if he had done well. He was running out of money, and you need money to operate these primaries. I think that he was afraid. I personally think that he would have won Pennsylvania had he stayed in.
Do you really?
I do, yeah. But if you win 52-48, you know, what can you say? My feeling was is that any point that Romney got over 45, he could basically claim victory. So it was going to be muddy.
It isn't quite summer yet.
It's getting muggy.
But let me just pick up on that, because what many people were thinking that he couldn't win in Pennsylvania. Obviously, you were anticipating a kind of a squeaker for him, but nonetheless.
Romney had not started spending money in the state, and he has run effective negative campaigns and had begun and was going to begin with a flight of ads in southeast Pennsylvania that sort of basically said, you rejected him 6 years ago, really bad. Why would you want him to be your candidate for president? Right. And I think that that's a strategic ad. It doesn't appeal to any ideology, but I think it was designed to appeal to what I would call moderate progressive Republicans in the burbs, of which there's a large number. Those ads never actually went up.
That's right. Exactly.
Or if they did, they went up for like a half a day, yes. Because Santorum's daughter took sick, and the Romney campaign decided not to run it, and then by the time she was well, he had decided to drop out.
And I guess we should count our blessings, right?
For what? The fact
for not having to hear this barrage of negative
ads. That's your view. I thrive on this stuff. I would have loved him to stay into Tampa personally. I'm sort of the resident expert on Santorum, and there's not much call for that these days.
Well, I want to get back to that, but let me go to you, Mike. And what did you make of Santorum's candidacy?
Well, let me. Can I back up just half a page? Because this is an opportunity. I don't very often find myself in disagreement with Tom Perrick. So
really?
Take full advantage
We're all ears, Mike.
I think Santorum would have lost had he stayed in. We were polling in the race and watching it pretty closely, and the trajectory of his support was going down in the state and going down very quickly. He had considerable momentum coming out of the March primaries, but then when he lost the large states, the last one being Wisconsin, but before that Ohio and Michigan, and he had really lost a lot of his steam, even though he still was a viable candidate coming into Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania polls were beginning to reflect that. In addition, as Tom has pointed out quite correctly, the Romney campaign was getting ready to run a lot of ads in the state. They had a huge buy planned, as I understand it, and that certainly would have hurt Santorum more, particularly in the eastern part of the state. And I think, given the fact that at the point that he got out, it was probably virtually a statistical tie before any Romney money had been spent, I believe it's very likely that Santorum would have lost the state, conceivably by a decisive number.
Well,
but certainly he would have lost the state.
But is that because Pennsylvanians essentially knew Rick Santorum, whereas other states were not as familiar with him? And he did lose by something like 16 points, which is a pretty dramatic win in 2006.
Well, I think one thing that has been forgotten, that early in the primary, in the Republican primary, he was not polling well in Pennsylvania at all, and he looked like a loser if it got to Pennsylvania. But But after he had won a couple of primaries and his momentum had begun to build, particularly on the basis of the Southern victories, then his numbers started to go up in Pennsylvania again. So he had gone from not looking so good in the state to looking pretty good, and then he went back down again. So I don't think it was so much a reaction to the 2006 loss, which I think can be explained in some ways that go beyond anything he did in his campaign, although I believe he made the loss much worse than it would have been to Casey in 2006. But I think it was simply more that the Pennsylvania electorate, as most primary electorates do, were influenced by the previous contest, and the momentum was beginning to lag because he was beginning to lose those big state contests.
Tom, do you think it was certain things that Rick Santorum said, calling colleges indoctrination mills and the president a snob for wanting people to get an education beyond high school, Kennedy's speech about religion and the presidency wanting to make him throw up? I mean, he did talk about other things, but these seem to be the ones that got a lot of attention.
Rick was one of these guys whose greatest weakness was also his greatest strength. And his greatest weakness for the general electorate, for regular folks, was sort of this Savonarola moral imperative guy. You know, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and if you disagree with me, his insistence on talking about issues like contraception, which people thought they had settled in like 1960, his moral righteousness or self-righteousness if you don't like him. So that in 2006, I think a lot of that turned voters off, especially Democrats and independents. On the other hand, who was voting in the Republican primaries?
Exactly.
The most conservative of the conservatives, the Tea Party people, the people who found him to be an appealing candidate precisely because of his moral righteousness, precisely because of his, what I would say, his combativeness for Christ or whatever phrase you want to put on, and Christianity. And I think that that's what turned him on. He had another factor, which I think, you know, everybody had a little dust of this. He was not Mitt Romney. And you may recall that there are other people who were not Mitt Romney. You had their moment, not Mitt Romney's. And I think that looking ahead, just from a technician standpoint, in the Romney campaign has to be a little bit concerned about the fact that they have a Republican nominee about whom Republicans are not enthusiastic.
Yeah.
But that's what I thought Rick did. He tapped into that. And he's also, I will say, and I think Michael will agree, a very skilled and accomplished politician. He knows politics. He knows how to present himself, and he knows about how to campaign.
And we're almost about to break here, but he's also consistent on certain issues.
Absolutely.
I mean, relentlessly consistent, I guess, on certain issues.
Yeah. Don't expect him to retreat. No retreat, no surrender, no victory.
And that's Tom Farrick, who joins us along with Michael Young. We are, in a sense, getting ready for the Pennsylvania primary. It is tomorrow. And yes, while Rick Santorum has suspended his campaign, his name will be on the ballot. It'll be interesting to see if people actually do vote for him, along with Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, and Newt Gingrich. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We're interested in the races that you're following, the issues that you care about. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
AM 1112 Productions, Philadelphia's all comedy theater company, supports WHYY. On now at AM 1112 Productions, Boston Marriage, the celebrated comedy by renowned American playwright David Mamet. Boston Marriage stars Grace Gunglewski and Suzanne O'Donnell as a most unconventional couple in this comedy full of sharp barbs, intense loyalty, and more than a little scandal. Boston Marriage runs through May 20th only. Tickets and info at www.1812productions.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. It's the first day of the spring membership campaign, and we want to hear from you. Since you're listening to Radio Times, you know what WHYY means to you. You turn to us for news and for in-depth analysis and discussions. That's what we do every day on Radio Times. So pick up the phone and call 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-9499, or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Are you going to vote tomorrow? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Do you have the requisite IDs in order to vote? Although I should add that tomorrow is a kind of a run-through that even if you don't have the proper ID, you will be allowed to vote. There will be some tallying at some of the polling stations to figure out how the system is working. But come the fall, you'll need a proper photo ID in order to have your vote count. We're talking with Tom Ferrick. He's senior editor of Metropolis. That's a news and commentary website based here in Philadelphia. Michael Young is a managing partner of Michael Young Strategic Research and also co-author of a twice monthly column published by Franklin and Marshall College called Politically Uncorrected. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tom, let me go back to you and even picking up on Mitt Romney and Mike. I'd like to get you back in on the conversation as well. But so where do you think this leaves Mitt Romney? And he's, as you said, he's had to fend off these not Mitt Romneys for the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. But it looks like those folks have pretty much fallen to the wayside. But where does that leave him?
Well, it's a little bit like one of those old time comedies where someone runs very quickly to one side of the room and then the room tilts and then he has to run very quickly back to the other side of the room. Romney's been running towards the right. Because he had to.
Yes.
That was the nature of the constituency. That's where his opponents took him. It wasn't Mitt Romney who made those statements about birth control and contraceptions, but he doesn't have the ability to escape those. And so now that it appears he is going to win the nomination,
right.
He's going to have to run back to the other side of the room. I mean, the question is how Mitt Romney is going to do in the fall. My question back to you is which Mitt Romney? The Mitt Romney of the primary campaigns, mm-hmm. or the Mitt Romney who was the governor of Massachusetts, who was, frankly, a moderate Republican?
Well, Mike, just picking up on that, and all candidates have to tack right or left depending on which side of the aisle that they're on. But do you think this is a particular problem for Mitt Romney only because we're living in the age of YouTube and there have been so many positions that he has been on both sides of?
Well, yeah, I think that's an excellent point and one that that both campaigns are going to probably be addressing more in the coming days and weeks, because it seems clear to me the Democratic strategy from this point forward is going to, at least over the next several weeks or even month, to try to paint Romney into the corner that he has painted himself into, and to try to keep him in there, trap him in there, define him as that conservative or that nominee of a conservative party, so that when voters who are now beginning to pay attention, many, to the general election, they get reintroduced to Mitt Romney as the conservative, as the guy who owns these positions, even though, as Tom Ferrick has correctly pointed out, they were foisted upon him to a large extent by other candidates in the race. Nevertheless, he owns them now. And there's going to be a concerted effort on the part of the Democrats to see if they can nail him in that corner and keep him there. And if that happens, in the nature of American elections, he's going to have a very difficult fall campaign getting back to the center where the so-called median voter is, and
right.
where elections are won and lost.
We're literally where the votes are, right?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. We have the registration shows there's 882,000. Stop back. There's 8 million registered voters in the state. Of that, 2.8 million are Republican, 3.7 million are Democrat, and another 882 are nonpartisan, independent, other parties. If you are a Republican and you get the Republican base is now less than 35%. So in a sense, if you're a candidate, you think, I will hold that base, that's 35. You've got to get that 15 or 16 from somewhere else. It has to be from Democrats or independents. And can you do that? That's the question. In this state, that's the question.
Well, and the base is these are the passionate voters. These are ones that, care deeply about some of, and if we're talking about Romney, these conservative issues.
Yes.
You know, can you keep them in line and also fold in these more moderate Republicans?
That's his challenge.
Yeah.
And or what they used to call Reagan Democrats. I mean, that is the challenge. Now, you know, we have to say a couple of things. One, we actually haven't had a campaign. We haven't had Obama versus Romney. Number two, we don't know about the externals. Like, for instance, ask me, I think if the most important question for me is.
Yes, go ahead.
Tell me what the unemployment rate is in September of next year.
Right. This year, excuse me. Yes.
This year, it's right now it's 8.2% in Pennsylvania. If it's lower, if there's a signs of a quickening of the economy, then I think that that all accrues to the advantage of the incumbent President Obama.
Yeah, I agree with that. We can talk about things that I think that matter at this stage in the campaign and point out those dynamics. But when push comes to shove in this campaign, it's going to be about the economy, and it's probably going to matter what is going on in the economy in that third quarter of the year. That's specific, I think. If unemployment is still going down, if economic growth is still continuing, albeit modestly, then Obama's going to be in pretty good shape. But if the economy is not improving, if unemployment is not going down, then it's going to be Romney's advantage. And the election is going to turn, to a very large extent, not on these conservative liberal issues, not even on the big issues like health care, but on the economy. That's what the voters care about. They care about jobs. They care about their future. That's what they're worried about. And they're going to elect an ex-president based on how they feel about that, I think, in the October or even into November of this year.
Mike, I'm going to put you on the spot because you do polling, so you're telling us that whatever polls we read today really probably don't matter because it really will be decided in September and what the unemployment rate is.
Well, I'm going to respond with a terrible cliche, but it happens to be an accurate one. Polls are a snapshot of a point in time.
Right.
They tell you what's going on now, if they're a good poll, and maybe into the future slightly, but they're not going to predict the future. Polls do not predict the future. They can tell you where you're going, where the road seems to be leading, but they can't tell you for sure what's going to happen in the future. But what we do know from past presidential races and a lot of research that's been done is that of all the variables that you can look at, that it is the economy that matters the most in most elections, and certainly in a year like this one where we've all been through some very tough economic times, that is what is going to matter to voters, the median voter, the average voter. And that, I think, is going to determine the outcome of the election in the end.
Tom, let me just ask you a question. I was reading actually in your old paper, or it's still here, but you're not there, the Philadelphia Inquirer, that there was a Ron Paul rally yesterday. It was pouring rain here in Philadelphia, according to the paper. There were, you know, 1,000 or more than 1,000 people that turned out for Ron Paul. What do you make of his candidacy? And he's only won a couple of delegates. He hasn't won a state yet, and yet, you know, he continues, and his supporters are certainly enthusiastic.
Ron Paul is a genuine libertarian. He excites the base of libertarians. Many of them are younger people. He believes in minimal interference, and for instance, he's against certain things like foreign policy. and he believes in minimal interference, and he's the lure of candidates like that is that they have a all-encompassing answer to every problem. It's like the people who used to run on the gold standard. Well, what's the problem? Homelessness. Going back to the gold standard, we'll take care of that. And the libertarian thing will, you know, he has consistently polled 5, 7, 8% of the electorate, but he can't move beyond that.
But he is the libertarian candidate. I mean, self-described.
Well, he's running for the Republican nomination,
yes.
But his political philosophy is libertarian. I think it always got me about libertarians. They would come and see me work at the paper. And they talk about how we should be free and there should be no drug rules, no prostitution rules, no this. And I said, if you all want to be free, why do you come here all wearing black jackets and black ties? If you want to be free, just take your tie off, for God's sakes, and dress in turquoise or something. It's true, though, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah, absolutely. It is true. You know, another thing about Ron Paul is he's lucky. I'm being a little facetious here.
Yeah,
but
go ahead.
But the Republican Party is lucky that he has a son, Rand Paul, because it's generally believed that he would probably put on a third-party candidacy this year, which is going to be his last shot at the presidency, which he could do, a very viable one, and it would undoubtedly cost the Republicans any chance at the election. But the thinking is that he has decided not to do that, in part because he believes that his son may have a future as a presidential candidate down the road, and that would destroy him in the Republican Party. But he does have, as Tom's pointing out, he has this dedicated constituency of true believers who will follow him anywhere and go anywhere and work very hard. And that's a powerful force within the Republican Party if it can be leashed to the party's interests.
And I do want to get to our callers, but Tom, anything you'd like to say about Newt Gingrich and his candidacy?
I have enjoyed every minute of it. And I love – what's that movie? Who's the guy?
Oh, dear. Here we go.
No, no, come on.
Okay.
There's that movie, the people who make the movie, and one of them starred I'm losing it. It was one of those movies where you didn't know what was going to happen next. You know, you go to a movie sometimes, you figure, okay, now they're going to – that's Newt Gingrich. You never know what he's going to say next. Now, he's a non-factor politically right now. He has no chance of winning it.
He's
but
got
I think,
no money. He's
but the spotlight's
support.
On, the stage is there, the mic is open, and he will step forward. He's a little bit like the Jesse Jackson. You know, if there's a camera nearby, he will appear.
And that's Tom Farrick, senior editor of Metropolis, a Philadelphia news and commentary website. Also with us is Michael Young, and he is a co-author with Terry Madonna of Politically Uncorrected. It's a twice-monthly column, and it's published by the Franklin and Marshall College. He's also managing partner of Michael Young Strategic Research, and we are drumming up interest and enthusiasm about tomorrow's primary in Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's see what Ruth from Westchester has to say. And Ruth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Go ahead.
I'm a very enthusiastic supporter for Roger Howard. He's running against Dominic Pileggi. We've become disappointed with Pileggi's inaction. He's got a Republican majority. He's the Senate Majority Leader in Harrisburg, and yet he really hasn't done much to reform the pension programs that are going to bankrupt Pennsylvania. Roger Howard has pledged not to take the pension when he leaves office. He's truly a citizen advocate, and he's going to help reduce the debt burden that has like a jackboot on our economy. Turns out Pennsylvania is the most expensive place to operate a business in the country, and with the U.S. being the most highest tax rate in the world, that makes Pennsylvania one of the most expensive places to operate a business.
Well, so, Ruth, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. Let me toss that first to you, Tom.
Well, I wish him luck, but he's not going to beat Pileggi.
Really? You're here to say
he's
that?
He's a Senate leader. I was doing some work on this. It's very, very difficult to beat an incumbent legislator. And I'll give you an example. I did not look at Pileggi's campaign finance report. I don't know how much he's raised. But I've looked at others for Senate leaders, and Dominic Pileggi is a leader in the Senate. The president pro tem, Joe Scarnati, in the Senate in 2011 raised $1 million. That was off-season. He's entering this year with $1.3 million in his campaign account. He has no opponent in the primary or general election.
So what's the money for?
What's happened over time is that Senate and House legislative leaders have become de facto the party, and they end up being PACs, and they end up giving a lot of their money to fellow senators, which helps them win re-election or win election if they're challengers, and makes them, the word beholden comes to mind, but friendly towards the person that gave them $25,000. Keep in mind that in Pennsylvania, we have no limits on the amount of money you can receive, nor the amount of money you can spend. There are no limits, unlike the federal law and unlike in Philadelphia, where you're limited in the amount of campaign contributions, and we do not have public funding.
Mike, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. I think, as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, Tom, you had a column this morning in which you addressed that whole issue. You had a great metaphor in there about being about the donut and not the hole.
Mm-hmm.
His point was, as I understood it, was that the lack of competition really in these legislative races should be the story rather than the handful of races in which there are contests. I believe it's accurate, these numbers are accurate, that we have four state senators who are being challenged in their primaries this year out of the 25 that are up and 28 state House members. There are a significant number who have no challenge in either the primary or the general election. So in an age in which we are so dissatisfied with government, or at least critical of government, incumbency is still king, and there's much too little competition in our elections, in large part because of the funding streams that incumbents are able to generate and pass out, as Tom has just described.
Ruth, thanks for the call. Let me get, looks like Anne from media to join our conversation. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm having a little trouble hearing. The sound all of a sudden went down.
Okay, just keep talking there, Anne.
Okay. I was interested in finding out more about Kathleen Kane because I was familiar with Patrick Murphy, and I wanted to find out more about their background. And in Sunday's Inquirer, they had a nice article about the attorney general race. And one of the things that really struck me is that is the funding for the campaign, because according to this article, Kane has $2.2 million in cash on hand, and $2 million of it comes from her husband, who owns a trucking company. And Murphy has $1.6 million on hand, and they don't say any, you know, particular huge donor or anything. And also, I understand she lives in a million-dollar house. And it struck me that money has been playing such a big part in elections that even though I would like to see a woman, you know, I like to see women get elected, I'm one, and but that money thing really bothers me. I'd rather support Murphy because I have a feeling that his backing comes from a variety of sources rather than one huge source.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Mike, let me toss that to you. We were talking a bit about money, unlimited money, campaign money, largely in the state of Pennsylvania. Anne's concerned about the money coming from largely from one source, her family.
Well, yeah, there's no question about it. She is a self-financed candidate, but she's far from the first one or the only one or the last one. Pennsylvania, among all the states, is wide open, Dodge City, in terms of campaign financing. Anybody can contribute any amount with a couple of limitations on unions and corporations. So it is a frontier mentality in Pennsylvania in terms of not just a lack of public financing, as neighbor New Jersey has, but an enormous amount of private financing and flexibility in doing that. And elections are largely about money today. The caller is absolutely right about that. And a candidate who can self-finance has an enormous advantage over any other candidate. But Kathleen Kane is not the first to discover that.
Yeah. Tom, we're almost going to break anything.
I will step back into the Wayback Machine to 1976 because Congress, after the Watergate scandals, passed campaign finance reform, and an aspect of that was to limit the amount of money an individual could give to his own campaign. That went before the Supreme Court. Running that year was John Hines for the U.S. Senate seat and Bill Green, mayor of Philadelphia. Well, actually, he wasn't mayor at the time. But that ruling, I think, came down in June that said that they cannot forbid individuals from supporting their own campaign financially. At that point, John's campaign list went from 78 pages to a postcard of people who could contribute to his campaign because he was incredibly wealthy and was able to self-finance and beat Bill Green, who was a tough candidate.
Interesting. Tom Farrick, Michael Young, we are talking about Pennsylvania politics, getting ready for tomorrow's primary and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll talk about the photo ID law after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Act Two Playhouse presents the classic Broadway musical My Fair Lady. My Fair Lady features such memorable Lerner and Lowe songs as Wouldn't It Be Loverly, Get Me to the Church on Time, and I Could Have Danced All Night. Starring Tony Braithwaite as Henry Higgins, My Fair Lady, directed by Bud Martin, runs at Act Two Playhouse's intimate 130-seat theater in Ambler, April 24th through June 3rd. Tickets and information at act2.org or 215-654-0200.
Hi, I'm Marty Moscowane. Reminding you that you play such an important role here at WHYY. We depend on you for financial support, and you depend on us to bring you news and information that keeps you both informed and entertained. What's that worth to you? You decide and call 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks so much for doing your part.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. Opening May 22nd, the new hospital is being built with all single-patient rooms and has been designed with innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a new rapid-response emergency room and CHOP docs to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Opening May 22nd. More at PrincetonHCS.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Michael Young, who joined us by telephone, and he is a co-author of Politically Uncorrected. It's a twice-monthly column. It's published by the Franklin and Marshall College. Also with us is Tom Farrick, senior editor of Metropolis, a Philadelphia news and commentary website. Let me also give a shout-out to our NewsWorks website, also follows Pennsylvania politics. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tom, let me toss this first to you, because tomorrow is a bit of a test run. That's mm-hmm. the word that's being used to describe this new voter ID law, which is that you will be asked to show your photo ID when you go to the polls. If you don't have the correct one or your license is out of date or whatever, you can still cast your ballot.
Correct.
But come in the fall, mm-hmm. you need the proper photo ID. Otherwise, you cannot vote in the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, actually, you can vote, but you have to cast with a provisional ballot.
Right.
And then you have to bring in proof later.
Right. But, yeah. I mean, certainly.
But that's true. You cannot vote that day.
Right. Sorry.
Except provisional.
Certain hurdles here. I guess the question is, mm-hmm. and there are the supporters of this talk about voter impersonation, the idea of people going to vote and pretending that they're somebody else. You've covered this state. You know Philadelphia politics really well. Do you think that's a problem?
No. No. It's not a problem at all. There are
individual cases.
There is the three types of voter fraud, if you want to bore your listeners, are three types.
We do it every day.
Okay. You're so good at it. You buy votes, you engage in absentee ballot fraud, or you do what I call inside jobs, poll workers racking up votes. Like we read it happen in Russia recently. You know, they keep I have seen all three types done. They don't exist as much as they used to. I think the system's a lot cleaner than it was 30 years ago. Most of the voter errors that occur, and I think we saw this in Florida in 2000 with the presidential race, tend to be technical or human glitches, not attempted fraud.
What's a hanging chad or
right.
something like that?
Voter impersonation means I'm Bill Smith and I'm going in and pretending I'm John Jones. That's very rare. It just doesn't happen all that much. There's other ways of doing it. The other thing about voter fraud is that while it's possible to do it on a retail level, it's possible for me to buy 20 votes. There was a candidate for elective office in West Virginia who was tried by the feds and convicted for buying 26 votes for a race for like local controller or something. But try to take it up to a new level, and it's really almost impossible. I mean, let's take John Cain in Philadelphia in 2008. He got 16 points in the city. Suppose you wanted to get him to 19, a 3-point extra. Well, you would have had to go out and buy or steal 21,000 votes. Oh. It's hard to do that without people detecting it. So it's sort of like the line on this is a solution without a problem. In reality, if you look at the history of this, a lot of this voter ID stuff originated in the Karl Rove White House, and it's designed to cut slices off of turnout among Democratic-inclined voters. A couple of points here, a couple of points there. And Roe was a master at that. And that was an organized, coordinated campaign back in 2006. And the only reason it didn't happen here is we had a Democratic governor. Now we do, so it's arrived here. So.
Wait, with Governor Corbett. Mike, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I guess that my point would even be sharper than Tom. I agree with everything that he said. But beyond that, it's really just a blatant attempt to suppress the vote of people that tend to vote Democratic. The people that are going to be affected by this law are disproportionately poor people, minorities, older students in many cases. And it's a substantial number. I've seen estimates approaching a million and a half people who will be challenged, or could be challenged, theoretically could be challenged, at the polls, lacking for the identification. And as far as the provisional ballot, that seems to me to be an unfunny joke. You have 6 days, as I understand it, to bring valid information to the polls, and it will take weeks, if not months, to actually get that identification for people who don't have a driver's license right now. About 1.5 million Pennsylvanians, it's estimated, don't have it. So it's a blatant attempt to suppress the turnout, and I think it's a very obnoxious thing for any party to do in a country in which we experience turnout problems already, and we have voter apathy. And so anything to discourage voting more than we have already discouraged it, I think, is very bad public policy, and it's, I think, a very unfortunate law.
It has an insidious intent.
With insidious intent.
The intent, you're saying, being voter suppression, that
yes.
is preventing
Absolutely.
People from
Absolutely.
Voting.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And Tom's point about a solution without a problem, it absolutely, there's no empirical evidence that I've seen at all of any significant voter fraud. So it's a law that had no real purpose, but could have a lot of mischief before it's done.
But Mike, do you think, and this is, of course, getting into the fall election and in a close race in Pennsylvania, do you think it will have an impact?
Oh, it absolutely could have an impact. When you're talking about those kinds of numbers, potentially as many as a million and a half people challenged or who would not be able to produce voting cards. Now, in practice, many of those people are less likely to vote, so you're not going to see numbers like that at the polls. But in a close election, and Pennsylvania elections are often very close, even though we have had five straight presidential elections in which the Democrats have won, many of them have been close elections. And this one is likely to be very close. So it is a law that could have an impact in the end that may turn the election.
Yeah, let me say that.
Go ahead, Tom.
I wrote a piece today that said it divides Pennsylvania voters into the haves and have-nots. If you have a driver's license that's valid, you're okay. You have to go in and flash it. If you do not have a driver's license, the steps you have to take are these. You have to get a birth certificate and not a photocopy. You have to get a embossed one. If your name changed because you got married, you have to get a marriage license, original copy. You have to bring a Social Security card, not the number, the card. You have to have two proofs of residence, like a utility bill or a mortgage or a W-2 form. And if, for instance, suppose you don't have your birth certificate. Well, it costs $10 to get it. And I was told yesterday by health department officials that it takes 10 to 12 weeks to get the copy if you mail in. It costs $35 to get a marriage license. I frankly think that some of these constitute a de facto poll tax for the steps that people have to take. Now, let me say, I think that a court challenge to this will require experience with the law.
Right. So you have to, in a sense, prove.
You'll have to have cases.
Right.
There was a case I read about in the Inquirer today about a 90-year-old woman. The guy took her in. She had a different name because she was married. That was on her birth certificate. She had everything else. She came in a wheelchair. They wouldn't accept because her marriage certificate was in Hebrew. And they couldn't read Hebrew. So they couldn't testify. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that's going to happen.
Right. But unfortunately, it's not going to happen this year.
No, it's not. It may happen in the fall election.
But I don't think it's going to reach it. There's not going to be a court decision before.
Oh, no.
Before
no,
the fall.
No, no, no.
And the ACLU is certainly making noises about challenging the law.
Yes, but, you know, there was a Supreme Court decision in 2008 on an Indiana law that was photo ID, one of the first ones. And one of the funny stories out of that was that one of the first people they netted back in 2007 or 8 were four nuns who went to vote and didn't have voters. But and those nuns, you've got to watch them. But but the Supreme Court ruled at the time that it would not allow a facial challenge to photo ID. There's nothing inherent about voter ID that allows them to enter and intervene to turn it over before it goes into effect. However, the Supreme Court said, but come back to us if there are specific problems and cases that you can build. But you have to have an election. You have to have people turned away to do that. I don't think the primary is going to be a good test.
Yeah.
Because there's so few people are going to show up.
Yeah.
And what they should have done on this law, quite frankly, is if they're going to have a test thing, It should have been the November election when a lot of people show up. You should have allowed them to vote but sort of warned them off. But that wouldn't have the effect that the Republicans wanted, which was the suppressed turnout.
If this had been a good faith effort on the part of the Republican legislature in the first place, they would have delayed it until they would have had a so-called tryout or dress rehearsal or a soft rollout in November, and then the next election, perhaps next spring, a serious effort to see what it looks like. Mm-hmm. But instead, the law was pushed through only a matter of a few weeks between the signing of the law by the governor and the actual election. And so it's going to be really a charade, I think, tomorrow in terms of election officials. Many of them have not been trained. They're not ready to deal with whatever problems they do encounter. Some are able to count problems. Apparently, many of them will not even be able to report on the experience they've had. So it's going to be just a charade tomorrow. And then in November, it's for real, with no real experience to help the election officials in administering the law.
Mike, let me roll back the clock 4 years to the Democratic primary in Pennsylvania. As we know, Barack Obama lost big to Hillary Clinton in the primary, went on to win the state. But how is the president seen as you poll and look across the state?
Right now, he is slightly ahead, but nationally, it looks like it's a tight race. Real Clear Politics average, I think, is about 3.5 points, with Obama having a lead over Romney, and many voters still undecided. So it's a race that's yet to be run nationally. In Pennsylvania, Obama is not doing quite as well as he is nationally. He's down a little bit. His job approval's down a little bit. But the odd thing about that is that Pennsylvania economically is actually doing better than many other states, just slightly better, but still doing better. And given the state's preference for Democratic candidates in the past, it should be a good state for Obama in the fall, but it's a very tight election at this point.
And Tom, I was reading that for Democrats, and this is for the president, that he has to win Pennsylvania to win the White House. Republicans can lose Pennsylvania and still win the White House. Does that fit your analysis?
Yeah, the key states here are the large undecided states: Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida is very key, and Colorado. There's probably some others, but I'm talking about the ones that have, like, we have 20 delegates, you know, 20 electoral college votes. So this is a key. We will be seeing a lot of these candidates in Pennsylvania and Ohio come the fall.
In the last three election
big
cycles.
Big swing. Now, he won.
Now, is Pennsylvania a swing state?
Yeah.
It is. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it's in the gray zone. You can't call for Obama. You can't call for Romney.
Right.
New York is clearly New Jersey's leaning to Obama. New York is clearly Obama, et cetera. Last time he won the state by 11 points, I think. Was that it? Yeah.
Yes, it was. It was a substantial victory. Nothing like that's going to happen this time. It's going to be 3 points, maybe 4 points. The critical thing, as Tom is pointing out, but it's worth repeating, is that the Democrats cannot afford to lose Pennsylvania. If you look at the various scenarios of the electoral map, they lose Pennsylvania, they lose the election. Republicans can still win in the Electoral College by losing Pennsylvania. So they have an advantage in that they can play offense in Pennsylvania, whereas the Democrats absolutely have to win the state. And that gives the Republicans a little bit more running room in terms of their national strategy. But they're going to be in here fighting very hard for Pennsylvania, just as the Democrats are.
And that's Michael Young, who joins us along with Tom Ferrick, talking about Pennsylvania politics. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Roseanne, looks like, from Reading to join us. And Roseanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi there,
everyone, and thank you for this wonderful program. I'm worried about the voter ID issue because I'm handicapped. I wouldn't be voting tomorrow because I'm a Democrat, but I am looking, you know, toward November. I was always excited when I bought this house that across the street was the polling station. I have never missed an election for 20 years that I've been in a wheelchair wheeling myself across the street. But, of course, I don't have a driver's license, and my passport has expired. Mm. And so I have to get someone to take me to the Department of Motor Vehicles to get a non-driver ID. So I had to get my birth certificate from Vermont. which I got. I have, still have to get my marriage license to show the name change from Minnesota. And Social Security card, who knows what that is. I hear it's going to take me 3 months. And just getting everything together so I can get that ID to go vote, I want to cry. The polling station's across the street.
Oh.
And I'm really worried. I have friends in the neighborhood who are also handicapped, who do not drive, who do not even know that, you know, where the Department of Motor Vehicles is, and I'm still trying to line up everything. I just want to say it is a hardship for those of us, and most of us, we are Democratic, most of us who are, you know, handicapped, or I have a blind neighbor, she's going through the same thing. I just want to say it is a problem. I don't know what happened.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You should know that even if you're a Democrat, you can vote tomorrow. There's nothing that prevents you from voting, and there are Democratic candidates that you can vote for. But Tom, raising the point that you just raised about the hurdles that people have to go through in order to get a voter.
It is a law with an insidious intent, and it was designed to be that way. And I will tell you too. You know, we had mentioned people without drivers. 40% of the adults in Philadelphia do not have driver's licenses. It amounts to 460,000 adults. But in Philadelphia, we're within walking or bus distance from the Social Security office, the PennDOT one. Out in areas that are rural or areas that are – these are 40-mile rides to each one of these offices. This is a real hardship.
And Mike, we're about 45 seconds before I have to say goodbye, but your final thoughts. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I wanted to congratulate the caller for her commitment to finding a way around this law, and I hope more people do that. But it is a law with insidious intent, and hopefully the courts will correct it in time.
Well, on that note, it's been a great pleasure to have both of you with us on Radio Times. Michael Young, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
And he's managing partner of Michael Young Strategic Research, co-author of Politically Uncorrected, as I have said several times, a twice-monthly column published by Franklin and Marshall College. Tom Farrick, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Tom is a senior editor of Metropolis, a Philadelphia news and commentary website. I should give another shout-out to our own website here, newsworks.org. Tom has covered government and politics in Pennsylvania for many years, since 1974, and he spent many of those years at the Philadelphia Inquirer as a reporter, a columnist, and an editor. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.